Hi, this is Chris, the CEO of IWC, and in this episode, together with Andrew, we'll be covering all of the background story of IWC in Formula One. We'll be talking races, we'll be talking the teams, and we'll be talking about a special period of us entering Formula One just before it went to that symbiosis between Lewis Hamilton, Toto Wolff, and all the great things that happened.
And there's a preview of the Qiddiya racetrack, which is like a mix of Mario Kart meets Hot Wheels meets some kind of crazy...
Six Flags.
Six Flags. Tune in. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. I'm here with Chris Granger Air, the CEO of IWC.
Chris Granger Air? Is that the Nike's new twist?
You are an Air Max. If there are other Chris Granger Airs, you are the Max version. And we are doing a podcast series about IWC and Formula One.
Yeah, we are. And of course, there's nobody better to talk to about Formula One than you. You know, frequent visitor to the paddock, the pit lane, and all things hospitality. So exciting. You've been to Melbourne GP recently. I haven't been at all this season, so you're one step ahead there.
Well, look, I must admit, Chris, that I am the innocent abroad. I am the ignoramus when it comes to Formula One. And I have been reminded of that since my interview with Max Verstappen at that Grand Prix, where I started the interview by saying that I just binge-watched Drive to Survive, not knowing that I walked into his least favorite topic, the absolute worst possible first question. So we are here to talk about something that I don't know a great deal about, but I am slipping down this rabbit hole. I know a lot about watches. I love watches. I love IWC, but I am so new to Formula One. And this is part of the journey of this podcast. I want to see where it goes. We're going to do four episodes. We're going to explore the connection between the brand and racing, but we're also going to see where the journey goes.
Let's do it.
It starts with a wrist check because this is still a watch-related podcast and you are sitting there on the commute thinking, okay, I've pictured the guys. There's Chris there and there's Andrew here, but what are they wearing? And I don't mean that, you know, inappropriately. Why don't you describe what you're wearing clothes-wise and watch-wise, just in case they were wondering both?
Yeah, but today we're sort of semi-casual. It's just a light blue shirt, a jacket, white trousers, some Santoni loafers, and the good old trusty Engineer Automatic 40, which is an amazing watch. It's the one I haven't taken off since we launched it a couple of years ago. Stainless steel, black dial. It's something that's designed for that viewing distance when you wear it yourself. It's not a watch that's designed to be effective at 6 meters distance. It's really something that works beautifully with the light when you wear it. And it's something I still haven't found anything wrong with the dial after all these years. So that's why I think it's stuck with me. And I see your beautiful Mojave Chrono 41 there.
This is the funny thing. This is not a new watch.
No.
By a long shot. But it's taken me, it's my latest new watch. Mm. And it's taken me some years to decide.
You need to buy an entire wardrobe first of tan and sand and natural colors. That's always the issue with that.
I ran myself into a position. There was so much beige in my wardrobe that I absolutely had to finish the job. Yeah. Now, this is the pilot's watch. The pilot's...
Oh my God. Top Gun chronograph, 41 millimeter.
Thank you so much. Thank God there's a watch expert in the room. And
funny story to this one, actually.
Tell me.
You know, it's. I was driving back from the very first shooting day of Top Gun Maverick, which I believe was 2018, I think, in September. And I was inspired by seeing all of the flight suits up in China Lake, which is the most secretive base the U.S. Navy has. And, you know, you see these like tan kind of tactical outfits, which at the time was very much sort of the sneaker and streetwear kind of fashion as well. You saw a lot of olive and a lot of tan. And I thought, I wonder if we could do a ceramic watch that would actually combine sort of this tan color with sort of the tactical strap kind of idea and create something which is very tonal in the Mojave Desert colors. And I thought about what could we call it because all the Top Gun naming was already done. And in the end, I pulled into a place called Mojave Mart, which was an Exxon gas station. And I was on the phone to Nico, who leads our product strategy department. And I was like, can you do an IP check on Mojave Desert? Because I actually really like it for that kind of beige color. And he came back to me a couple of hours later and said, yeah, Mojave Desert isn't taken. It's free in the watch industry. I said, let's do it. And that was the beginning of that Mojave Desert color and the ceramic watches.
That's what I was about to say. Why are we doing this podcast? What are people going to learn? But it's stuff like that that never makes it to, like, our videos are so rapid. They're so intense.
Yeah.
We have 17 and a half minutes with someone like Tanya, who's in the room with us now.
I know. Our minders. Last question now. She's especially good at, you know, when you're in a really dreary interview where you really can't wait to get out, she gives you all the time in the world. But whenever I enjoy any conversation, she's like, okay, that's the last question. Now.
This absolutely is unacceptable. So
well, great credit to Tanya behind the scenes.
No, she's here giving us the finger in a nice way. But no, we
both fingers.
We rush through these things and we never get the, there's so many richer stories and they're usually happening when the cameras are off. So I thought we'd try to capture them. But it's funny you say that about the Mojave, because just yesterday there's a new Mojave Top Gun pilot's watch, 41mm. So it's rolling out the ceramic. Is this just going to keep happening now with Woodlands? Are we going to see?
Well, that's the thing. You know, we
consistency.
Yeah, consistency. And I mean, there's always, for me, there's always a point when strategy ends, and strategy ends at the point of, is it a nice watch or is it not a nice watch? And that ultimately, it's just an emotional gut feeling sort of reaction. Ooh. So we don't systematically do every watch in every function, every color. But Mojave Automatic, like Tahoe Automatic, was one of those. It just the density of the dial versus the density of the case and the mass of the color in the case just works, you know, much better than it does in a big Pilot Automatic, for example, 46 or anything like that. So in the end, you know, yes, there is a bit of system behind, but you just go for the watches that work out just fine. And that was one of those where we saw it the first time. It's like, okay, yeah, automatic we have to do in Mojave Desert.
So that gave you, in our unscripted, and again, who could I do this with? Who could I do a whole podcast mini-series with that's in a CEO role? Just you, basically, in my opinion. Unscripted, you're just happy to go there, and that's hopefully what we'll deliver with this series, as well as stories behind the scenes of Formula One as someone who's had an incredible box seat to an era. There's been some scenes with your partner brand, and we'll get stuck into that too. But can I ask you the question, why should people listen to this series? What do you hope to reveal?
Yeah, I think especially when we're talking about Formula One, I really walked into Formula One as almost a complete novice. You know, I was big into my cars, but much more into touring cars, DTM, production cars, GT racing. I wasn't very big into Formula One until I sort of rocked up at Formula One and started to really understand that Formula One is a complete behind the scenes business. And nowadays it's a huge entertainment property, but I really think there is so much more when you come to experience the sport and the world behind. And I started to enjoy it a ton more. And I think the success probably of things like Drive to Survive are really down to giving people that lens into the actual sport. Because, you know, if I'm completely honest, like back in the day, just watching it, usually like in the German speaking world, you watch it on Austrian television for whatever reason. The sports always tend to be Austrian commentators, which is very fitting with Toto. It's always one of those things. You hear these Austrian voices. But, you know, having the 20 cars go around 50-odd laps of a Formula One circuit can at times be pretty uneventful. But then when you actually step into Formula One and you meet the teams and the people behind and the engineering, you understand that like absolute mass of statistics, calculations that goes into the sport, that's when it comes to life. And I think more we can give people a little bit of an insight into the inner workings and the sort of the world behind, the more interesting it becomes when you then see the drivers on the podium and the cars going around the track and beautiful liveries and all the rest of it.
You mentioned human stories because that's what's hooked me. I feel that Drive to Survive, and again, I am just a staunch supporter. I don't care if that makes me an F1 novice. I don't care if that invalidates me or makes Max Verstappen not like me. It's just the way that my brain is wired. The campfire gene is something we all have that gets hit by this series that tells the human stories behind behind the houses, behind the individual you know, exploits, that all of the incredible backstories that these people have. And it's truly, in a Shakespearean way, kind of given us this larger plot and this larger sort of narrative arc of the good guys and the bad guys and the old guys and the young guys. And I just find it, I do tend to wait the season out until Drive to Survive. But this season is the first time that I know enough about the narrative threads to want to follow it race to race. And this is 2025 is the first season that I have actually started following the race weekend to weekend or race to race. So it's really fresh for me. Yeah. So I'm where you were in the beginning. But can we talk about you for a moment here in terms of your time at RWC? Because I have memories of you that stretch a long way back. 2013 is when this partnership started, but when, tell me, where does that time in with your career at IWC? Because you weren't CEO then.
No, absolutely. I think that was a time when I was mainly still in store design and architecture. I did things like Watches and Wonders. I did traveling exhibitions. And I think we just come off a Top Gun year, which was 2012. And for me, that was like the first moment where I felt incredibly lucky because I, you know, there's a really close relationship between the whole world of aviation, Top Gun, and that world of Formula One. And when I started at IWC, that very first week, all of the marketing and the press, I mean, you weren't there, unfortunately, but all the press pack came back from the USS Ronald Reagan from an aircraft carrier overnight trip to launch the Top Gun watches back in 2006 in autumn. And I was so gutted and absolutely depressed that I had missed that trip. And obviously, I wouldn't have been invited anyway. But for me, this was just like, oh my God, they've been to an aircraft carrier. They've seen all of this stuff live. And, you know, all our sort of, you know who journalist friends were there to experience North Island, San Diego, flying out in a Hawkeye onto the USS Ronald Reagan, arrested landing, then like spend the night on the carrier and back in, the whole story. So I was gutted, literally. And I still have the jacket to prove it. And from that point on, I started to look into this whole world of Top Gun and what is behind, and I didn't understand why we had a different patch on the back of our watches compared to what you see on the pilot suits. And I started to research all of that. And then in 2012, this one. And it's basically, it's the movie logo, right? It's a logo designed by Paramount and Bruckheimer for the original 1985 Top Gun movie. And this was gifted to the Navy afterwards by Paramount. And then basically when it came to giving us exclusivity over some sort of Top Gun IP, they gave us this one because obviously they couldn't give us the military patch as an exclusive. And this is how we ended up with this particular logo on the back of the watches. But anyway, for me, like this all ended in 2012 when I had the opportunity to then build a Watches and Wonders that was a complete aircraft carrier replica with an actual FA-18 Super Hornet simulator that I've drawn and constructed from thousands of photographs and actually had built and a company that makes aircraft mock-ups next to the aircraft carrier shipyard in Newport News in Virginia. And for that to come together, and then 2012, we did a full roadshow of this flight simulator experience. We did Dubai Mall in the big atrium. We just thought about this the other day when I met Sarah again, who organized it back in the day in Saudi, and we had this huge setup and trying to get, you know, these aircraft simulators into Dubai Mall. It was an absolute nightmare. We went onto the Red Square in Moscow with a Top Gun simulator, can you imagine? all of the Middle East. So again, it shows sort of the non-political kind of vibe that Top Gun still has. And coming off that year, then really starting the first year in Formula One and having done an aircraft carrier the year before, my job was to create the pit lane at Watches and Wonders, basically. So
this I remember. I remember there was a tilted Formula One car. Is that right?
Yeah, there was. It was actually, well, the tilted car was Juan Manuel Fangio's SLR Mercedes from 1955, which was a Mille Miglia winner from back in the day. And this was a 30-odd million euro insurance value car that had to go into Watches and Wonders right at the beginning of construction works and then be protected by security against falling stuff and interfering people like 24/7, and it was like the biggest panic. But we had in the end 7 Formula One cars there, including Michael Schumacher's last ever Formula One car that he'd actually driven with the engine in, which got delivered to his house after Watches and Wonders as the souvenir Mercedes car to end his career at Mercedes. We had SLS safety cars, 2 of them, the iconic Gullwing SLSs. Funny story there as well, Geneva Police, I shall not say. And then we had various Formula One cars for that race night where we did a pit stop challenge with our FOBs, etc. So it was a huge setup. And that booth in the end was a wind tunnel in the center. It was a pit lane with double garage on the left. And I actually built a custom-made huge Scalextric track where Formula One cars, Scalextric ones, would actually run through a glass-covered tunnel in the bar and then go around the back and come back down again. So people, as they were sitting having a drink, they could play Scalextric with both the SLSs and the Formula One cars. So yeah, that was a cool year. And so I was completely new to that, but I had to find out basically in a couple of months how Formula One works, how to represent it, how to activate it. And that for me was a learning curve, like it was for you with Drive to Survive, and then bumping into Max and asking him that question he likes so much.
So someone listening might think to themselves, hang on. The CEO of IWC 10 years ago or thereabouts was designing the booth at Watches and Wonders. That doesn't sound like a traditional path to the top spot.
Yeah, I guess it's not. I must have left an impression somehow.
I don't want to state the obvious here, but I designed the booth and now I run the company.
Yeah.
What happened?
God knows. No, look, I think, you know, and I think the good thing is if you're in store architecture and you build a factory, you get to know like every element of the company quite well. You know, if you do factory planning, you get to know how a watch is ultimately made, which is important. And doing all the stores, you learn about all of the markets, what they need, customers' requirements, you know, how people like to be served in the Middle East versus Japan versus Europe. And you've been to all of the countries and you know all the teams. So that's a very good starting point. What's not so good is that you don't know anything about finance, HR, you know, management. You know? But at least, you know, I think you can come into a role like in two ways. I mean, ideally, you know everything, but nobody does. But either you have ample CEO experience, especially in the luxury industry, or you know the company really well. I think I knew the company really well. I had a very, very good team around me, and that helped a lot. And yeah, the rest is a learning curve for sure.
Amazing. That is inspiring for people that are shop architects dreaming of one day running their company.
No, but I think, you know, in a sense, just to finish off on that, I think architecture and the watch business, they relate to each other in the sense that architects also, they try to create an atmosphere people can feel by coordinating a ton of very technical and very specific things, from materials to lighting to surfaces to soundscape to fragrance to whatever it is. And in the end, you don't want something that you have to explain for hours on end, but you want an environmental system that people walk into and they get a feeling and uplifts them. They're like, you know, we try to do essentially the same. We have thousands of parts in these little watches, but in the end, when you put a watch on, you wanted to tell a story. Like in your case, you know, it's that story of that Top Gun pilot, you know, and how that watch came to look the way it does, down to technical requirements. But in the end, it's a watch that gives you a feeling, gives you an emotion, gives you an emotional response. And I think in that sense, what we do in architecture are quite closely related.
And if you want to see more of that in live action, we are in the room with Marcus, who you are likely to know from other podcasts and other adventures with Andrew and Marcus. But we did perhaps the most athletic and exhausting run through of a manufacturer with Chris.
We did, yeah.
Who has not only designed the booths at Watches and Wonders before his time as CEO, but also designed the manufacturer, which is an incredible experience. And it's a very, what you just described then, that sort of holistic experience of a space, I just urge you to watch the video, get a sense of what you're in for, and then book a tour of the space, because it is designed for a customer or an IWC lover's experience, and you've got to do that. But let's go back to the topic at hand here, which is 2013, IWC take on Formula One. How many years? At least 10 years before it begins its zeitgeist run. Mm. And I would say, how close are we to the top of that, by the way, in your mind? Do you think we are approaching the peak, or I feel that there's actually so much to go?
Yeah, so I've just been to Qiddiya in Saudi Arabia, where they're building that Formula One track that is fully embedded in a theme park environment, in a whole entertainment city. The scale of the next
Vegas. Sounds like Mario Kart.
Yeah, and it's Dubai meets Vegas on steroids with an absolutely unique Formula One track that actually, I mean, it's mind-boggling when you see it. So it will be a night race, of course, because it's in the desert. It's surrounded by this like huge cliff. It's a 200-meter horseshoe-shaped cliff that's surrounding this Formula One track. The track can be extended to 21 kilometers, all the way longer than Nürburgring Nordschleife, of course. It has a canyon loop attached to it. And then turn one will be 70 meters cantilevered up in the air. So drivers will actually drive up at like a 10% gradient to 70 meters.
It's called then, Hot Wheels or something, the one where you do the loops?
Yeah, the loop, exactly. Yeah. Then it goes underneath like a glass bottom swimming pool along the biggest water park in Arabia. And then it goes alongside the fastest, highest and longest steel roller coaster in the world, which accelerates up to something ridiculous, like 210 kilometers per hour, and does a 200 meter straight cliff dive and all the rest of it. And there you'll have an environment where the Formula One track is really fully integrated into a theme park experience. I mean, the roller coaster is inside of Six Flags. I mean, that's just, you know. So I think in terms of this development of it beginning in somewhere like Spa, where it was really motorsport enthusiasts, you know, at a track, you know, watching mechanics and it being just solely focused on the sport via things like Monaco, Miami, Vegas, where the entertainment side of things, the lifestyle side of things got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then you had the content behind it, like Drive to Survive or the F1 movie, all the way to the actual merger of a fully like curated theme park environment in Formula One. And this we'll see in Yas Island in Abu Dhabi, because Disney will open a theme park next to the Formula One track there. And who knows how that's going to play out. And then Qiddiya, where basically Formula One happens inside a full theme park experience. So I do think there's still some way to go. The strange thing I find is that at the core of it, you still have, per team, two cars, two drivers going around a track. And when you look at the sort of the little ecosystem of the 20-odd mechanics working on these two cars with tools, tape, you know, sticky, like blue tack, all of this stuff. And you look at it, like I was walking the Monaco pit lane a few weeks ago, and you see how small all of this is, right? It's really tiny, and it's just two cars, and it's really a small space. When you transport all of the circus into these huge environments, it almost seems surreal that it's still only like, you know, six, seven mechanics working on one car. But this world around it has become so big, it almost is like a misfit now in terms of the scale of things. And you saw this when Formula One started shooting the movie, that the Apex GP Formula One team actually brought more trailers, more equipment, more setup than any other Formula One team. Like their sort of paddock and all the rest of it was bigger than anybody else's. And it just shows how entertainment is sort of taking over Formula One in a sense. Right? Yeah. And I think it still has some room to go, definitely. I mean, how was Melbourne this year? I mean, you saw a fresh season Grand Prix this year. How did it feel?
My point of reference is I'd been to maybe four or five races before this. I'd been to Monaco a few times. I'd been lucky to go to Monaco. And interestingly, the first time I went to Monaco, it was with Tag Heuer. And it was somehow quite sort of humble and pre-fame.
Yeah.
It was sort of like a tugboat. It had
branded porta toilet, bottle of Coke.
But strangely enough, it was not a luxury yacht, and it had the branding was slightly askew.
Yeah,
and it was charmingly so. Like it just wasn't this big sleek
DTM vibe
production. It was just a good honest boat. But on that boat were Chris Hemsworth, who, as an Australian, I interviewed him so many times that at this point we'd become somewhat civil with each other, and Matt Damon. So there was all the Hollywood pizzazz, but on this sort of, you wouldn't call it a luxury experience by any means. But that was, again, before Drive to Survive had really kicked off. I don't think there'd even been a season at that point. So that was a point of reference. That was when there was still a sort of an honesty to it. Yeah. Celebrities went there to escape.
Yeah.
Like on this boat in Hercules Harbour, there was no paparazzi. There was no way for people to access them. So they felt that Formula One. That's true. Yes. They should have known. I did get one or two shots. I got a shot of Matt Damon taking a picture of Chris Hemsworth, which is one of my favorite sort of stealth celebrity snaps. But I was well behaved. I left them alone. We'll
have to share our favorites on our iPhones one day just to see, you know.
I think you'll have me well and truly down. But this was definitely a different era of Formula One. So I'm comparing to that race, and I think what I saw the difference this year at the Melbourne, because I was there again with Tag Heuer this year in January. And I think it's just the LVMH takeover, like seeing the Louis Vuitton branding everywhere. Hospitality is now not Tag Heuer, it's LVMH, it's Louis Vuitton. So there was the spaces themselves were so beautifully dressed and so luxurious that the guests were different. The celebrities were definitely not just sort of mincing around having the buffet breakfast with you on the boat. It was all more controlled and it's all gone up a level. But in terms of the race itself, I agree. I think the part of it that feels small now that everything else has got so big is the actual, we were right above the racing and looking at the amount of drivers, and we did the tours and so on. And you look in and just think, you can see like loose screws on the floor and you can see the.
Hopefully not.
This was in,
which team was that?
This is Red Bull, as it happens. You're a great rival. But no, I was overwhelmed by, or I got a sense that this has all just gone up a pay grade. And in a way, I think it's inevitable. And I think the luxification of anything tends to mean, as a guest, that the experience goes up. But I did feel an enormous difference from watching the race a few years ago.
Yeah, for sure. And for me, there was this big moment. I think we had re-signed our Formula One contract just before COVID, I think, or just at the beginning of COVID. And at the time, I literally got that question a lot, saying, why do you sign this again? It's only for like middle-aged
what was that,
European
22?
Men. It would have been, I think, 19 or 20, I think, but somewhere thereabouts. And at the time, really, it was a motorsport enthusiast kind of event, right? And
that's another point. The crowd has changed dramatically.
The crowd has changed totally. And then I remember COVID came, Drive to Survive came, and that effect afterwards was really, really incredible. And the first race we went to was Zandvoort in Holland. And I remember driving up to the paddock gates in Zandvoort, and all of a sudden, the road was lined with kids that seemed
teenagers,
8, 10, 12, 14-year-olds, had never seen that before, trying to catch a glimpse of the Totos of this world and all the rest of it, and the drivers obviously coming in. And I was like, what is going on here? And then in Zandvoort, you have this unique...
like five dips like the Beatles.
Yeah, you have this unique setup where the motorhome sort of sits on the other side of one of the grandstands, and it has an outside seating area. And I was inside with Toto, and every time Toto opened the door, like the whole grandstand would go crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
And he hadn't known this before, and I didn't understand it either. And I said, what are they cheering at? And then I realized, oh, they're cheering at Toto. You know, no idea. Or at the time we met, same year, we met in London at our Bond Street boutique to go for lunch. And before that, Toto wasn't really that famous. But all of a sudden, as soon as we stepped out into Bond Street, 3 meters like down the road, he was inundated with fans asking for selfies, autographs, and it was all new. So that curve of it becoming really, really mainstream, and you know, to the point that this Miami Grand Prix, somebody said to me, "Oh, it's dreadful. You know, I guess only 10% of the people at Miami Grand Prix know what's going on in Formula One." I said, "Well, good. I mean, that shows you that, you know, the scale of lifestyle relevance it's actually gained, right, over the years." But that effect was crazy.
If we're looking at two points and two reference points, why did IWC get into Formula One in 2013 when, again, this would not have even been in the wildest dreams of what this partnership could yield in terms of reach, in terms of brand awareness? What was in, you think, it would have been George's? This is George Kern, the CEO at the time's decision. What was his thinking then, and how much, how has it evolved since? How's the partnership, how has the relationship with Mercedes-AMG changed?
Well, I think it all started, I mean, Mercedes-AMG, that relationship goes all the way back to 2005. So it's the longest standing relationship between any watch brand and an automotive brand. And obviously at the time when Braun GP changed into Mercedes-AMG Petronas, it was Mercedes-Benz Petronas Formula One team back in the day, it actually was their works return to Formula One. After like a hiatus, which is like 50 years or so, you know, the silver eras were quite a long time ago. And I think because of that relationship with Mercedes and various connections, it was quite obvious that we should have the conversation. And in the beginning, I think we started off very consciously as an engineering partner, not wanting to be on the drivers, not wanting to be on the car, but just engineering partner. And we very, very much started off that way. And I think what happened then, independent of the success of the team and that unique relationship of Lewis in particular and Toto, is really that the teams really grew together very, very closely in a very, very unique way. And I think today what our marketing and comms teams do together with Mercedes' team and the things we've been able to pull off, I think it's just been a learning curve together. And it does feel in the end, and you always say, like, how does it feel as a sort of small wheel in the machine? It does almost feel like you're part of the team in the end. It really does. And, you know, and when I think back to Lewis's farewell in Abu Dhabi last year, and I was sitting there up in the paddock hospitality, and they had pretended to Lewis that he was going to do some press stuff, and he was like, "Why, it's Thursday evening, I never do press on Thursday, why?" And up there in the end was the entire Formula One team saying their farewell to Lewis, which was highly emotional. But I'm sitting there as the CEO of IWC, and around me is like only Mercedes people, right? And you're you realize that this is more than just a paid partnership, right? Because you've become, they're happy to have you around when the tears are flowing, like big style, right? And it just shows what happened over these 10 years or so. The teams have really grown together into something that is very, very organic. And it does feel like a very good marriage.
Okay. What were you feeling in that moment?
When the Lewis farewell.
Yeah.
I was in tears as well. And it's very, very emotional because I think deep down, both the team and Lewis knew very well what sort of era had just ended. And I think you reposted at the time a photograph from that when I gave Lewis his farewell watch. That big pile of perpetual calendar, Top Gun with the red accents, you know, sort of forward projecting. And I think they all knew, he knew, and everyone knew this was the end of a big era in Formula One. And it was something quite unique.
I do remember that post. It's interesting how the stories combine.
Yeah.
And talking about that journey, including the 10-year anniversary, which was another big moment for that partnership with Toto, did anything come from his – because he's visited the manufacturer, and I suppose it does – any watch geek listening to this right now is thinking, Andrew, ask him about – if you're an engineering partner, has there been any – pollination of engineering talent, of engineering ideas, materials ideas. Toto's at the IWC manufacturer. Chris is in the pit lane with the cars. Answer the people. What has been some insights, or what has been some stories from the way that these, no doubt, this sort of osmosis of teams and ideas, and obviously you're becoming a one big team. But what are some things you can tell me about that? I suppose, sharing of ideas or collaboration on a deep level, on an engineering level.
It was really interesting when we first met at testing in Barcelona, probably back in 2017. I had a little coffee meeting with Valtteri Bottas, who at the time didn't speak a lot. And I sometimes look back at the pictures, you know, both of us so baby-faced, you know, it's just really, it's nice looking.
You mean he wasn't back. Doing ads for Uber Australia at that time?
No, wasn't at all, though. No, and yet Toto joining us, and also when I look at the evolution now, you know, it's all very down to earth. You know, when in Barcelona, they have the DTM motorhome, which is touring car motorhome, and it's as you describe, you know, it's cans of soda, and it's very down to earth. And I think what I noticed with Toto is just we got on well. We liked each other from the get-go. And it seemed to be that we could talk to each other, and it was kind of sort of natural, which really, really helped. And then, yes, of course, the factory visits come, and I came to Brackley. And I think the cross-pollination, I think, is probably quite different from what you'd expect. It's not that we walk into there and go, ooh, carbon fiber CMC, you might use that. Well, it is a bit, but that came a bit later. Or that they come to us and say, oh, like, yeah, same machines as us, but a lot smaller. I mean, that's the first thing that anyone in Formula One will say. So it's basically the same machine park that we're using. It's just all scaled down by about factor 100. And our carbon fiber actually has to look nice, whereas their carbon fiber just needs to be very stable and very light. But it's not that immediately we're like, oh, we have to make a watch like this, or we have to make a car like that. But for example, one of the first things that they asked me was like, wow, we love your designs. We want to redo our team driver's suites on board the trucks for Lewis at the time, because obviously, you know, he had different tastes compared to what Michael had. And they invited me to Brackley to come look at their trucks and make a design proposal for the inside of the truck. So this was like one of the first things we actually did together was design, you know, where does the PlayStation go, and how, you know, how do we dramatically illuminate the helmet and the race suit, and what sort of amenities are in there, and all the rest of it, designing Lewis's toilet, you know, that kind of stuff. So it's sometimes a bit where you don't expect it, or then, you know, working together on that garage for Watches and Wonders, you know, finding out with them what sort of, you know, things, because they, you know, in a typical event for them, they would have had, like we have here, you know, gloves and prop helmets in, you know, acrylic showcases put into a hospitality lounge for a big corporation. And that's about as far as it goes. And we're like, no, we want to recreate a theme park universe of you walking into Formula One garage, and it has to be movie-like. You know, we don't just want, you know, helmets and gloves in the corner. And that for them was also like a completely new way of looking at it, to the point that we really exchanged a lot of notes on their new garage when they came to redesign their entire setup. And then obviously Joe Kosinski took that one step further with the Apex Garage for the movie, where again they went in with all the design. So it happens on many different levels. I think in corp comms between Ricardo and the team, there was a lot of really learning from each other. Some things they do extremely well, some things that we were quite good at in terms of storytelling, in terms of bringing stories across. And that's really where how it happened over years. And there's many, many projects that none of us would have done on our own, all the way down to watches like a Total Wolf Virtual Calendar Edition, which is 100% down to his WhatsApp voice note briefings, me coming with a prototype, him rebriefing and having new ideas and meeting new people. And that's really the uniqueness of it.
I'm going to do something totally forbidden now.
Sure.
No, we're still rolling.
What are you finding?
Don't move. I was asked in Vanity Fair to list... they talked about the death of the concept watch and how it's a shame that there isn't that level of especially with Only Watch going as well. It's a bit of a shame that there aren't many brands pushing for Only Watches. But just read number 36. This is unscripted.
The IWC Big Pilot's watch shock absorber XBL, because it can be resist shocks up to 30,000 G thanks to cantilever spring. Team Mercedes Formula One boss Toto Wolff, when he had an almighty tantrum. Well, it wasn't a tantrum, was it? It was just a reaction. At the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix in 2021, his headphones had been obliterated. I was watching it. Yeah, his PR stunt. But it wasn't a PR stunt at all. This was just genuinely that moment when we learned what Toto-proofing actually means, you know. And it makes me laugh because Mercedes has this, you know, famous product called the G-Class, and the G-Class carries a badge saying Schöckl-proofed, which is their house mountain in Graz in Austria, where every G-Class has to prove what it can do. And for me, this kind of whole idea that watches need to be Toto-proof because of that same Austrian kind of challenging environment.
So
That
storytelling was so good that I chose that as my favorite modern concept watch. And it's just that you didn't know that I did that.
No, I
thought that I would. I knew that would come into the story at some point.
Yeah.
So the last question for episode one, because we have covered some ground here, and I feel that there's such a rich story there. But really, if a Formula One fan is listening to this thinking, Andrew, for God's sake, just ask him what it was like to be in a box seat. I don't know if you could money buy an aspect on an absolute era of dominance like you had. I want to ask you, there's so many ways I could ask that question, but as someone that leads a team, as someone that tries to rally, Marcus and I work with a big team to try to rally for greatness. How do we drive better this time? How do we arrange our team so that we perform? You are a high performance person. This is something you pick up very quickly. What have you learned from being so close to greatness in terms of leadership and teamwork, watching that team perform?
Yeah, you know, where do you start? You know, I think it's a tour de force demo, especially when it runs at its smoothest. It really tells you an awful lot. And the good thing is about sports is always sport, as opposed to our industry, sport is always right or wrong, because it's winning or losing, it's factual. You know, there's not much in between. Either you cross the line first or you don't. There's not much argument there. You know, in the luxury industry, it's a bit more ambiguous, I'd say. But nevertheless, I think what you can see really from Toto's approach, and this is always much easier in theory than it is in practice, but it is about starting off with putting the right people in the right place. And that's not people, and this is something that's very, very key to Formula One. You know, when you look at maths, physics, statistics, you have thousands of highly skilled candidates. And it's just a situation I'm going through personally now, because somebody aged 15, 16, very close to us, she is a brilliant math mind, brilliant statistics, physics person, and she wants to get into Formula One. And I'm just helping her at the moment to try and come up with her CV and how to pitch it and all the rest of it. And I think the beauty is that you don't just hire the most qualified people for the job, but you find the people that have the empathy and that have the human qualities to perform really well in a team of a certain culture. And this is where it really does start. And then, it sounds very basic again, you give people the environment, the means, the framework, the governance for everybody hopefully to do their job. Then it's your job to have a vision. Very easy in Formula One. Let's win. It's not a very complex vision. All in performance, as they say now. And after that, what impresses me every single time with Toto, at least in the good races and during the period when we're winning a lot, during the race, he's one of the only team principals that doesn't sit up on the pit wall, but sits in the back of the garage. And why is that? Because he wants to let the racing and the strategy crew and the race crew do their job without any interference in an ideal scenario. And this, I think, is again, it's much easier said than done, but it's a very good learning out of that. When you've set it all up, and when you've decided on the goal, the vision, the strategy, and you put the right people in and everything is there, is to sit back and not to interfere, control, micromanage, but to let people do their jobs. So that's, again, anyone is far from perfect there, but it is just a very good approach. And when you hear them communicate during the race, it is like air traffic control. It's very similar to what you see in aircraft. It is all very calm, very controlled. There's no shouting. There's no erratic behavior. Everything, when they're in race mode, everything is super calm. And when they're winning, everything is extremely calm. It's not always like that, but when stuff is working the way it should, it is a very, very calm operation. And that, I think we see this sometimes. We see, you know, also in Tanya's world, you know, when events are planned and prepared the way that she and her team does, when you get there and when it's race mode for us, it's calm. There might be discussions before, arguments before, but when we get there, it just runs. Watches and Wonders, great example. It just works. And that's ultimately, I think, what you're trying to get to. That people know what they're doing, they know why they're doing it, and, you know, everyone can just go and do it.
To keep it F1, I think the ultimate contrast there is Bono, yeah, and Lewis.
Yeah.
And
Kimi and Bono.
And
yeah.
Kimi and Bono, or Lewis and Ferrari.
Mm.
And that communication tone has changed.
Bono is, if you're ever struggling to calm down, I would love to have a Bono radio soundtrack, you know, just to calm down. It's incredible. It's like the most soothing voice.
If there was an app, an AI assistant that's in Bono's voice so that you can talk to him at all times. Well, look, we've talked to you in your ear for longer than we expected, which I expect is going to be we're setting the running for these episodes. I absolutely love that episode. I did not expect it to go those places, but we are used to driving fast together because we get this limited amount of time, and I am going to enjoy every moment I can to get as much as I can out of these episodes. So thank you. A fantastic, would that be practice? I guess that'd be practice session one.
Yeah, or the sprint race. We'll see.
Or the sprint race. We'll see. In episode two, we're going to talk about the watches of Formula One. So if you are a Formula One freak and you came for the cars, then that's a strong start. But if you're a watch fan and you're waiting for the watch talk, then skip to the next episode because we're about to do it all again with a tray of watches and much watch talk. Thanks for listening. Chris, any send-off?
Thank you. No, looking forward to the next one. That was great. Let's talk some watches.
Indeed.